everybody. Welcome to the second lecture. I hope you had sweet dreams about the definition of manifolds. By the way, I uploaded like a preliminary notes for the week one on the wiki. So actually, if you want to read ahead, or if you want to read what we have done using my notes, they are now available there. I will not follow everything what is there and maybe change some things, but it's like a preliminary, something to start from, basically. Okay, so yesterday I gave you some formal definition of a manifold. So let's just draw the picture again. So manifold is an object which is defined only intrinsically, so by things which actually live on that manifold. And so it consists of points. So take one such point, and each point is actually contained in some open set in some ball, let's call it O alpha, and then locally this looks like R to the n. So there is a map from O alpha psi alpha to the R to the n and there is some open subset in R to the n U alpha, which contains this point. Okay, so that's, and basically you want to cover the whole manifold, and any point you take there, you always find such O alpha, at least one such O alpha that contains this point, and it's always this map psi alpha to R to the n. So now if you have another, let's say O beta, which contains this point, beta, and so there's some intersection between O alpha and O beta, of course, there's another map, psi beta, to the R to the N, to U beta. And then, of course, this intersection here will look like something like here, and something like this, let's say here. But now, there's a map from here to there. Right, so the map is just from R to the N to R to the N. So it's just a standard thing which you learn about in calculus. So it's psi alpha composed is psi beta minus 1. So I first go to the manifold, then I go to the other one. And then you require that this map is actually, let's say, C infinity. So it's very it's smooth. Okay. So what it actually means, so let's write down a motto. So a manifold is made of pieces that look like that like open sets. Open subsets of R to the N. And now let's be very beta R. Tune together smoothly. And it's because precisely of these maps, which map the R to the N, and then you have this standard calculus in between the R to the N, you can do normal calculus basically on manifolds. Right, so that allows you to define normal things. So by the way, size are called charts in mathematics, or they are called coordinate system in physics. So physicists would say there's some coordinates x and there's some coordinates x prime which live here and there, and my point has certain coordinates in one coordinate system and certain coordinates in another coordinate system. Okay, that would. And then O alpha together is psi alpha. So these subsets on the manifold plus the mapping, right, it's a collection of maps, and collection of maps is atlas. Okay. So let me just mention some examples. So the trivial example, let's stay in two dimensions. So the trivial example, of course, of a manifold is R2, right? So if you have a plane, that's a trivial manifold. Less trivial example is S2, right? So if I have a sphere, then that's a less trivial example, because now you actually need two charts. You need, so there's no one chart, one map, which would cover the whole sphere. So you probably learned about it. Tibra talked about it, about this stereographic projection, probably, and so on. So you need two charts here to cover S2. Another example is T2, torus. So basically, you can think about torus is that you have a plane, and then you compactify this guy with this thing, so you identify these things, so identify these two guys, and identify these two guys here. So basically, I wrap my paper like that, and I wrap it like that as well, and that forms a torus. So if you do that, you get your favorite donut. Okay, so this is an example of a manifold. This is an example of a manifold. This is an example of a manifold. Question is, for you, is this a manifold? So, in other words, does it look like R2 everywhere? Except at the tip of the cone. So this is the problem, actually. So it's not a manifold. So if you sort of remove, so if I take, you know, one, just one, and remove this point, and it will be a manifold. But if I have two, I cannot do that. And so this is not a manifold. So by the way, just a stupid note. If your fundamental objects are particles, as is the case in general relativity, quantum field theory, and so on, actually, this is all well defined on manifolds. So particles like manifolds. And in fact, if you don't have a manifold, you have big problems to define what you mean by, you know, motion of particles and so on. Okay. However, if you have more extended objects, for example, if you are in string theory and you have strings, so string theory actually works fine on less restrictive objects than a manifold. So string theory works fine, for example, on orbifolds. And you will learn about that, orbifolds. And you will learn about this in your string theory course. So, a canonical example of an orbifold is that I consider a domain where I identify x with minus x. So consider a line, and you identify this x with minus x. So now this is fine. So now it's like fundamental domain, let's say from 0 to infinity. Okay? So which is like, so this is like R1 over set 2. So you describe everything by considering numbers from 0 to infinity, 0 included. Okay, but it means that if 0 is included, it's not an open subset. It's actually, it has a boundary. 0 is a part of the boundary. So strings don't mind that, but particles would actually be singular if you have a boundary. Okay, there's a boundary, and that would be a problem for particles. So singular for GR, for particles. But for strings, they just don't see it. It's too small of a problem for a string, which is an extended object. So actually, the point of the whole node here is that, yeah, if you don't want to talk about particles, you better have a manifold. If you talk about other, bigger objects or whatever, you can be less restrictive on where your things actually live. Okay. So now, once we have defined manifold, we want to define some other structures on the manifold. So the simplest structure you can think about is a scalar function. Scalar function. And so you always want to define these objects so that they are actually invariant objects. So they don't depend on your particular choice of coordinates. So you want something which lives on the manifold and hence is independent of which coordinates I describe. So here's the definition. So a scalar function f is a map let's be just one dimensional, so from the manifold to R. And so you want an independent definition. So again, so I have my manifold here. This is my point P. And I want to define to this point P some number, right? So I have so my function f is a map from this point P to some particular number, which is the value of the function in that point P. But at the same time, let's say I have this contained in O and this contained in O prime, and there's this map to X and map to X prime. So the question is, if I describe my function on these charts, in these coordinates X and X prime, so how does actually the value of the function change if I change coordinates? Does it change? So if I take the value of f of p, now I describe it in coordinates x, and now I describe it in coordinates x prime, does it change? Should it change? No. It should be just the property of the fact that at point p, I have something defined. And no matter which coordinates I'm using, so from there, you have that f of p is f x of p, if I describe it in this coordinate system, or x prime of p, doesn't matter, right? So it's just the value of the function at that point, if you want. But of course, what it means, okay, so now this is f prime, because it's like I'm describing my function in different coordinate system, in a prime coordinate system. So what it means is that f prime at x prime is actually equal to f of x. And that's, if you want, a transformation property from one coordinate system to another coordinate system. And this is what you require from a function. Is this clear? So really it's like a property of that point P, if you want, no matter which coordinate system I'm using. Yes.
As a point on the manifold at the very beginning, but in the second and third equality, like it takes the value in the R, so it is a bit confusing.
So you can think about it. So that point is assigned some coordinate here, right? And I can equally think about it like it's a map from here to R, right? So I can I can first use my map, which is naturally the psi map, psi prime map, and psi map here. So I can first assign some x prime to it of that particular point, and then I can think about it's a map from this r to the n to r, which I know how to do it, right? So that's why I'm writing this argument x of p and x prime of p, just using a concrete coordinate system. Okay, a curve gamma on M is again a map So now, you know, curve is something which is inherently one-dimensional. So you want to parameterize your curve by a parameter which is one-dimensional parameter. So it's a map from some interval, which is a subset of R to M, such that, okay. So again, I will describe it in a coordinate system. So you have your map composed with zero comma as a function of one parameter t. And so now in my coordinates, I will just prescribe x1t, x2t, and so on, xnt. And so you want this to be smooth. So again, here's a picture. So you have this interval I where your t lives. Okay, so it's like t thing. So you have R here, and you take some subinterval of this thing, and you have a map to the manifold. So this is your curve on the manifold. And this is what you mean by that. But again, I can map this manifold to my R to the N. That means that I will have R to the N. There'll be a corresponding curve in R to the N. And that will be described by x1 of t, so x mu of t, if you want. It's a one-dimensional thing. Is this clear? Maybe. So, yeah. So, I don't know if you are used to actually think about curves. Like, you know, I describe my curve by very coordinates, which are function of one variable only. And so as I run my parameter t from, let's say, A to B, I just describe a curve from here to there. Okay, and the same thing you can do on the manifold. So an example of a curve, of course, if you think about Earth, it's a river. Okay. If you think about physics, it can be a trajectory of a particle or in relativity, it's called world line. Line of a particle. Okay. I just want to have it here, so I'll destroy this one here. So anyway, so similarly, you can talk about, you know, more dimensional things than a curve. So for example, you can talk about surface. Okay, similarly, a surface S will be a map from a subset of R2. So let's say I have some U here. So this is like a higher dimensional generalization of my interval I. And then you map that on your manifold. You'll create some kind of surface on the manifold. And this will be your surface S. And if you write it in coordinates, so again, that means that, again, I have a chart to R to the N. So in that chart, I'll have x1. But now, of course, this is inherently two-dimensional. So it'll be function of two coordinates, not only of t, but it'll be function of t and, let's say, sigma. Or tau and sigma, just to be in string theory. Tau and sigma. And again, example will be, so if you are on the Earth, it will be, let's say, a lake, right? It will be surface of the lake. Or it will be a so-called worksheet of string. this is easy peasy, right? So it's very simple. So now let's do something more complicated. So we have function. We have defined a function on a manifold, and we have defined what a curve is. But the central object of differential geometry, as you will see in a few weeks, is actually a vector. Okay, so now let's discuss the vector. Okay, and so this is really a central object of differential geometry, but it's a relatively complicated object. So let's do it slowly. So let's first do it in R to the n, where you already know what it is. So in R to the n, there are basically two views how you can view a vector. So view one, you can just think about it like a set of components, right? So it tells me, the vector is that big in that direction, that big in that direction, and so on. So you think about it like components, and you write it as a column or something like that. V1 to Vn. Okay. So that's something which everybody's familiar with. So now, view two. Again, everybody is familiar with this, but it's less intuitive. So you can think about it like a directional derivative. So in other words, I assign an operator V hat to any vector, which will be my components, which are here, V mu, and a derivative in the corresponding direction, dx mu. Okay, so there's one-to-one map from components to this operator, right? So I just take any coordinate system, dx mu. So V1 will tell me how much I'm differentiating in x1 direction, and so on. So if you want, I have a x2 and x1. So this tells me how I differentiate in that direction, and this tells me how I differentiate in that direction. Okay. So now, because it's a derivative operator, it satisfies basic properties of a derivative. And what are the basic properties of a derivative? Perfect. So exactly. So this is characterized by Leibniz rule and linearity. Okay. So in particular, if I want to know how this operator acts on a function, so on a function f, what it gives me is just this thing here. So v hat on f is just I put a function here, right? So it's v mu df dx mu. It's really how the function changes along the vector, right? This is basically a thing which will survive on manifold as well. So this will be basically a definition of what a vector on a manifold means. But let's do it very, very slowly. So let's consider a special case of this, even still in R to the n. And that will be a tangent vector to a curve. So what do you mean by that? So you have a curve, gamma. And let's consider one point there. So for example, this point here. And let's just take a tangent vector, which is, of course, a tangent to this thing here. And you probably know, so again, I describe my gamma in some coordinate systems, so it'll be x mu of t, right? That'll be just description of my gamma. And then if I want a tangent vector, it's a derivative of this, right? So my components of the vector are just dx mu over dt. It's the velocity, if you want, right? So then, using this prescription here, now I assign to this vector a derivative operator, which acts on my function f. And now I just use this v mu, which now takes a concrete form. It's dx mu over dt. So it's dx mu over dt. And whatever I had there before, df over dx mu. Okay. However, this is nothing else than a chain rule. So what this is actually df over dt. And it tells me how f changes along gamma. Gamma at point P. So far, so trivial, right? This is very, very simple, very intuitive, really, concept of a vector. So, okay, so let's use this as a definition, what you mean by a vector on a manifold. So, definition. Okay. Before definition, so we have another definition. So let F be a collection of all functions of C infinity scalar functions on a manifold. So then you say that the tangent vector let's call it V gamma, to a curve gamma on the manifold at point P is a map V gamma from a function, so now I really understand this v as a derivative operator. So it's a map from a function, and of course this is a number. So if I fix a point, you know, so this will be a number, right? So it's v gamma from function to a number. Okay, so v gamma. When it acts on some particular function f, you just define it in this way, df over dt. Remember that this is defined on that curve in that manifold, df gamma t over dt. And it's just a standard limit as you define a derivative. So limit s goes to 0, f of gamma, and now you take one point t plus s, and then you subtract another point, and you divide by s. Basically, I'm thinking about one point on the manifold, another point in the manifold, I subtract. That's the definition. Okay. So there's this, big intuition coming from R to the N, but you don't need that intuition. You can just take it as a definition. Okay? So now, of course, obviously this is coordinate independent because it doesn't use coordinates anywhere, right? It just uses a concept of a curve on my manifold, which is coordinate independent, and uses a function on the manifold, which is coordinate independent. So this is definitely coordinate independent. However, if I choose a particular coordinate system in a concrete coordinate system, let's say x mu, so d gamma on F, by our definition, is df gamma t dt, the tangent vector to a curve. Of course, now I write this gamma in my coordinates. So it's d over dt, if you want, of f. And then now I write these coordinates, x mu of t, which describe my curve, gamma, right? Now I use the chain rule because it's a derivative. So it's df over dx mu, and then dx mu over dt. It looks very trivial, right? Now I say, these are my components. Okay, so this is called, well, v gamma mu are the components of my vector. So you write it as v gamma mu df over dx mu. Trivial. Okay, so this is for one concrete function. But of course, now this must be valid for any function f, right? So what I can do is actually I can tear off my function and get whatever the vector is, right? So from here, so tearing off my function f, we have that v gamma, which means I start here, I end here, and I just take f away. Okay, so v gamma is d over dt, or v gamma mu d over dx mu, which is precisely like a derivative operator. Okay, so we defined what we mean by a vector along one concrete curve, gamma, right? But of course, it always happens that if I have my point P, it's not one curve which goes through that point. Well, this one doesn't even go through that point, okay? But there's many curves which go through that point. And to each such curve, I can define the corresponding vector. Right, so now take all the set of possible curves, and that defines a vector space in my point P. Okay, so considering all possible curves through that point P, your tangent vector in general will have exactly this form, but now I just forget about that gamma because it can be, I can choose any gamma basically I want. So I'm tearing off gamma now. So first I teared off my function f, now I'm getting rid of my gamma. So v in general will be just v mu d over dx mu, just tearing off gamma. So terminology, this thing here is called components of the vector. And this is called coordinate basis. And you know, if you return back to R to the N, it really tells me, okay, this is the direction I move, let's say along x1, and this tells me how much I move, right? How big the parameter is, and this is the generator, if you want. Is this all clear? Perfect. So, okay. That's basically all there is about vectors, but you know, it directly translates basically from R to the N. But you have to be just more formal to make sure that you are coordinate independent, right? So the definition there is coordinate independent, but of course, in a concrete coordinate system, it reduces to something you already know, because you are in R to the N, basically, then. So now, it's sort of like a derivative operator, right? So it has to satisfy derivative properties. So again, Leibniz rule and linearity. And one can show that. One can show that. I will not do it, but if you're interested, look in Walt or something. So first, linearity. So what I mean by that is that if I take my vector and I apply it on a combination of functions f and g, where a and b are real numbers, then of course this is a times v of f plus b times v of g. And f and g are functions. So linearity is basically obvious. And of course, the second property is also true, Leibniz rule. So if I have V acting on two functions, so I need to get a number, right? Or function, if you want. And this is all at point P. So this equals to, I differentiate one, let's say g, but I have to evaluate the other one at my point P, right? Plus, I differentiate the second one, so it's, I differentiate f, and evaluate the other one at point P. Okay, so you can show that. So basically, we have proved a theorem almost. You almost proved a theorem. So let me just formulate it as a theorem, but we basically showed it already. This is something which gets us all the properties of a tangent vector. So the set of tangent vectors at P forms, well, a vector space, right? A tangent vector space, a tangent vector space . The notation is, it's written as TPM. So P saying that I'm at point P, and M is my manifold, and T stands for tangent. And now we basically proved whatever I'm saying here, which has the same dimensionality. As my manifold M. And we actually proved that by really constructing the basis of the vector, right? The basis was d over dx mu, so I have that many vectors of the basis as I have components, as I have coordinates x mu, right? But I have that many coordinates x mu as is the dimensionality of my manifold, right? So we actually show that. The same dimensionality as M with coordinate basis is d over dx mu. So in given coordinates, I have these basis vectors. And then whatever I said here, so any vector v, and it's a linear combination of these basis, dx mu. Okay. So questions? So who has seen this before? Everybody. Ah, very good. Almost everybody. 80%. So an example, okay, I have my sphere, S2, and then you can choose some coordinates on S2. So natural coordinates are d phi, okay, t over d phi, and then this will be d over d theta, if you want. So now I have one point here. Oh, this is stupid. Okay. But at one point, I make a tangent plane to my sphere. This is precisely what you mean by t. So there's a point P. Tp of S2 is this tangent plane at that point. And then you have this coordinate basis there, which is d over d theta and d over d phi. They don't have to be orthogonal, yes. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So I think there should be a sign.
No, I'm changing theta, so this is fine. This is d over d theta, right? They are not orthonormal, yeah. Yeah. So finally, let me just mention, probably Neil define a vector in this way. So transformation of coordinates. So sometimes people say, well, a vector is something, if you take the components of that vector, it transforms in a certain way. So our vector is actually an invariant object. It's components plus the basis, if you want. So it is b mu of x, d over d x mu. So if you want, these are the components of the vector in one coordinate system. And then, of course, if I want to change coordinate system, I just apply a chain rule on this guy here. Okay, so this is v mu of x. And now I write it in coordinates x prime. So d x prime nu over dx mu d over dx prime nu. Again, I'm using summation convention. I'm summing over these things. Okay. So it's a transformation from x to x prime is the chain rule. But of course, whatever stands in front of my new basis has to be new components of the vector, right? So this is v prime new, if you want, at x prime. Okay, so we have a transformation law, which people sometimes take as a definition of a vector. So the components in one coordinate system are related to the components in another coordinate system in this form. And as I say, people take it sometimes as a definition of a vector. But vector is something which is invariant on a manifold. So here it seems like you are changing a vector. You're not changing, you're just changing the components of the vector, but the vector stays the same. Okay. Oh no. Okay, so far we talked about a vector in a point on the manifold. So now we want to extend that notion to the whole of manifold. Okay, so extend to whole manifold. And so let me just write the definition. So, you know, a tangent vector, now we are omitting at a point, vector B, is basically a union of all VP for all P on M, such that V of F is smooth. Okay, so I just, you know, I extend the notion to the whole of manifold, but I require that, you know, if you want, in one point it looks like that, and the other point it doesn't look like that. So that would be wrong. So I require that V of F is actually smooth. Okay. And then tangent bundle. TM is a union of all TPM on the manifold. Okay. Just a notion. And of course, if I want to specify, you know, if I take an object in a tangent bundle, so that's characterized by two things. It's characterized by the position on the manifold, so basically by coordinates of my point P, and the direction of the vector, right? So local coordinates on this, local coordinates on tangent bundle actually consist of, you know, what are the coordinates of my P, right? Plus what are the coordinates of my vector. It's actually now a space of x and v, if you want. Okay. Questions? So now we know everything we need to know about vectors. So let's move to something else. And that's actually a dual concept, a cotangent vector. So that one, the previous one was tangent vector. Now it's cotangent vector. Or sometimes called a one form, if you want. So I'll try to use consistently different letters. So let's use Greek letters. So omega at a point. So instead of V, I'm using the omega at a point P on M is a map So it's a creature that takes a vector, so it takes some vector from TPM and gives you a number. Okay. So interestingly, these also form a vector space, but it's called a dual vector space. Okay. So form. So before we had tangent vector space, now we have cotangent vector space. So to distinguish it from TPM, there's a star in addition to that, so it's TP star M. And there's a coordinate basis, this basis, again to distinguish from the basis D over DX mu, now your basis is DX mu, and this is defined by so this thing is a one form, so it has to eat a vector to produce a number. Okay, so you define it in this way, dx mu. Now you feed it a vector, which is just a basis vector, d over dx nu. Okay, and you get a number, and the basis is defined so that you get either 1 or 0, depending if you are in the same x, basically. So it's this delta mu nu. Okay, and then once you have the basis, okay, you write, so can write then that omega is some components. So it's a linear combination of its vectors, of its basis, and these are the components of my form. Again, so this is like an invariant definition, if you want, sort of almost invariant. So you can, again, define it by changing coordinates. So my invariant object omega in one coordinate system, omega mu dx mu. Now you want to transform to x prime, and for that you again need to transform your basis. So this thing, and you are again using the differential if you want. So this is omega mu of x dx mu dx nu prime dx nu prime. So this is my new basis, and what stands in front of that is my new components, omega nu prime. So omega nu prime at x prime is dx mu over dx nu prime omega mu at x. Again, it tells you how the components of a one form transfer from one basis to another. So by the way, if you compare how the vector transforms, so that relation there, and if you compare how the one form transforms, you can think about this thing as a transformation matrix, let's say A, mu, and nu prime, and then there will be some other transformation matrix, B, nu prime, and mu. So these will be inverse to each other, and you will show that in the tutorial. But it's very simple. Okay. So finally, all these things, again, if you extend, so this was, again, in a point, but if you extend it to the whole manifold, they form a cotangent bundle. Cotangent bundle. P star of M, again, I'm getting rid of P, which is a union of P, T P star of M, and the local coordinates will now be, so coordinates will now be x mu and then omega mu. Right, again, I have to specify the point, and then I have to specify how my vector in the dual space looks like. Questions? So now there is a natural projection from these bundles to your manifold, right? So basically, you want to kill this coordinate and just keep this one, and similarly, you just you want to kill the v mu coordinate and keep the x mu coordinate. So it's called canonical projection. Okay, and it's denoted by pi, and it's basically a map from, let's say, tangent space to my manifold, such that the pi of v gives me basically the point p. So, okay, so v, if you want, consists of two things. It consists of telling me where I am on the manifold, p equal to m, and then it gives me this vector v, which is tp of m, right? So if I take the projection, I just kill this part here and keep only where it is, okay? So in local coordinates, pi of x1 to xn and b1 to bn just gives me x1 to xn. And, you know, similarly, the projection works for the cotangent bundle, just throwing away the omega. Okay, so similarly, for t star of m. And by the way, just to throw a word there, the tangent bundle and cotangent bundles are so-called fiber bundles. So it means like they are like, so you have a base manifold, which is M, and then you are building up spaces. So you fix a point P on a manifold, and then you're building an extra space above that point P, which lives at that point P, basically. So this is called fiber bundles. And you will need them when you study gauge theories and stuff like that. Okay. So now this will be probably enough for classical mechanics course. But let's think about relativity course, and just let's give you a cookbook how to deal with vectors and forms and tensors. And tensor is a natural generalization of these two objects. A tensor of type K and L is a multilinear map so let's call this map T like a tensor and it basically okay, maps from TP star times many times TP star k times, and then TP L times to a real number. Well, that's a definition. So basically, again, it's a beast. You have to feed that many vectors, L vectors, and then you have to feed that many forms, and it gives you a number. Okay. And of course, vector and one form are just special cases of this. But again, in GR, what is most important that it in the components. Transform basically as if it were that many times vector and that many times a one form. Yeah. So in new coordinate bases, I have coordinates alpha, beta, and so on, k times. And then I have coordinates, components mu nu, and so on, L times. And so in the new basis, this equals to, and it's precisely those matrices which we used over there. So it's dx prime alpha, dx, some new thing here, and so on, k times, and then dx kappa over dx prime mu, and so on, L times on t delta and kappa of x. Okay. So basically I use the same transformation as so if I have a one-form index, I transform it with this matrix. If I have a vector index, I transform it with that matrix. And so a cookbook tensor algebra so let T and S be tensors. Then you can basically they form something like, well, T plus S is a tensor if they are of the same Mullins. So you can add tensors. You can also multiply them. So it's something which is called tensor product. And it's denoted by this thing here, so T cross S. So now this will have coordinates alpha and mu and so on, and gamma and kappa and so on, and it's given basically by adding components of T and S. So I have T alpha and so on and gamma and so on, and then I write another thing here, mu and so on and kappa and so on. So this is how it is defined. So basically you put the indices beside each other, and that's how you define the tensor product. There's another operation which is called contraction. And so let me just write T dot S. and gamma and delta and kappa and mu. And so basically that you can sum over some indices which appear in one tensor, another tensor. So alpha, beta, gamma, and so on, kappa, and so on, and then S, alpha, beta, delta, mu. Okay. So the same index appears here, and the same index appears here. So again, using Einstein summation convention, it means that I'm actually summing over alpha and summing over beta. So they don't appear in the final expression here because I sum over that. And of course, by summing these things, I am reducing the rank of the tensor, if you want. So each summation actually reduces by 2. Right. So by the way, again, terminology, the indices which you sum over are called dummy indices. And the indices which survive, which are actually the real indices, are called free indices. And you know, the final property is that, of course, tensors are invariant objects. So it means that, in particular, if tensor is zero in one coordinate system, it'll be zero in any coordinate system. So although this seems very trivial, it's very powerful when you're actually doing actual calculations. Okay, questions to this? Dennis will have to start at 5. So now we know what manifolds and tensors are. So the next step is actually to do some calculus with tensors, right? So can we actually differentiate tensors? Can we integrate tensors and so on, right? Because after all, in the end, we want to write some equations, which are actually our equations of physics, and they are usually differential equations or integral equations, if you want. So we need to know if the physics is described by tensors, then how to actually differentiate and integrate these tensors. And the simplest concept, which is actually not usually done in GR, is the Lie derivative. Okay, so T of the Lie derivative. And I'll tell you what the problem is. So differentiation of tensors on M, on a manifold, is actually quite problematic. Okay, so think about, for example, a function of one variable, of t. So then you define df over dt at sine t0 is a limit s goes to 0 in the standard calculus t0 plus s minus f t0 over s. It's a standard definition from calculus, right? So now, what is the problem here? Well, for function, you can still do it. But if you have a tensor, let's say, what is the function? What is the problem if you are on a manifold? So on M, the first problem is that, well, you could say, well, I replace my T0 with a point on the manifold, right? So I evaluated object in one point of the manifold. But then you see that I need to evaluate one object on one point of the manifold and on a different point of the manifold. So actually, how do you define this plus S? What is that next point here? So replace, you may think you replace T0 by a point on the manifold. But the question is, of course, how to define the other point? So how to add S to P? Okay. So that's one thing. And another problem which is even worse than this one, is how to compare a vector at p plus delta p to a vector at p. And, you know, the problem is very serious, actually, one, because from the definition of the vectors, you always define a vector to live in a corresponding tangent space, right? So you have a manifold like this. So there is one. So I have one point here, and there is a corresponding tangent space, tangent plane, and my vector lives in the tangent space here. So now I want to compare it to a point p plus delta p, which has its own tangent space. But in general, this tangent space has nothing to do with that tangent space. So there's no way how you can actually compare object living in one space to an object living in another space. So that's a big problem. So actually, there must be an extra additional structure how you can say, well, there is a unique way how to actually associate this tangent space to that tangent space. And that requires an additional structure on the manifold. Okay? So need additional structure. And there are three most common possibilities how to do that. So possibilities. So one of them is, the simplest one is the Lie derivative, which we'll discuss in a minute. And for that, the additional structure is a vector field. Okay. So I need to have, not only manifold is not enough, manifold vector field U, but I need to have some kind of vector field on my manifold, which tells me, okay, along this vector field, I can perhaps move this point to that point and uniquely associate this vector space to that vector space. That's one possibility. Another possibility is so-called exterior derivative. It's actually, I don't need any additional structure. But it doesn't work for general tensors. It works only for something which is called forms, which we'll discuss tomorrow. Okay, so it's very, very, you know, restrictive on the number of objects it can work for. And finally, the most complicated one, which is the one which is usually being taught as the first one, is the covariant derivative. And that actually requires an additional structure, which is called connection. Very, very complicated object. Okay, which is not even, you know, a tensor on the manifold. It's something very, very weird on the manifold, right? So this is the most complicated one, but the most useful one for general relativity, unfortunately. But anyway, so let us start with actually the simplest one, the Lie derivative. And then tomorrow we'll do the exterior derivative. And then Neil will do the covariant derivative for you. Or maybe Matt next week. So I'm running out of time again. So let me just do a few more concepts, maybe these two more concepts. So, definition, or a vector field U defines its integral curves on M. And so the definition of an integral curve is that the tangent vector at each point actually coincides with this vector at that point. So their tangent vector coincides with UP for all P on M. So a picture, so if I have my manifold like that, and then basically the integral curve will be something which penetrates, it's a curve on that manifold, so that at each point P, this will be a tangent vector UP to that curve, okay? And so this is there is a unique correspondence between a vector field and a corresponding integral curve. And the proof is very simple. So proof of the uniqueness, if you want. So in some coordinates, x mu, I just define that my curve, so dx mu describes my curve, so dx mu over dt is precisely my vector at that point, u mu x. So this is something I know, this is something I'm trying to find, and of course it's a linear differential equation and has a unique solution provided I provide initial condition for that. So unique solution. Okay, so there's always, for any vector field, I can define these integral curves. Okay, but this is actually very powerful. So once I have integral curves, I can actually map some points on the manifold to another point on the manifold, which is actually shifting along this curve by some parameter. Okay, so this defines a map phi t from a manifold to the same manifold by phi t, this maps from gamma at some parameter t0 to gamma at t0 plus some t. Right, so what it does is that I have my integral curves like this. Okay, so let's say I start with some point P or some point Q, and it's a corresponding vector UP, and it's a corresponding vector UQ. But anyway, so these are my integral curves, and I just map this point P, so this is for parameter T0 of my gamma T0, and there's another gamma T0 here, and then I just map this point to some new point P tilde, and then some new point Q tilde, where this will be actually T0 plus T. So I map phi T here. So it's basically, think about it like a river. So river drags something from here to there. It's along the integral curve, I can always do that. Okay. And interestingly, so phi t, so of course t is continuous because my curve is. So I can actually map arbitrary large parameter t and arbitrary small parameter t. So I can really map only here or there depending on how t is big, but it's continuous. Of course, if I take phi 0, so t equals to 0, it's an identity on the maps, on the manifold, so I don't change anything. Obviously, if I take phi t plus s, is if I do it one after the other, right, that's the same thing. And finally, if I take phi minus t, then it's just the inverse map of phi t minus 1, right? So what it actually means is that it's saying one parametric metric, and you will have a whole course on this Lie group. And now a strange word of diffeomorphisms. And I will explain you what a diffeomorphism is tomorrow. So let me stop here if you have any questions. So these are really, you know, basic concepts of differential geometry. So sooner you learn them, better for you. And there's many, many, you know, textbooks where you can read about these things. And just open any textbook on general relativity or differential geometry. I would rather say on general relativity, because in, if you open a really pure math book, it gets very complicated and you get so many terms and notions which you do not really need. Okay.